Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In August 1862, two Union soldiers fighting in the Civil War were gravely wounded at the Battle of Second Manassas. This battle was a horrible slaughter of Union soldiers, and thousands died. These soldiers may have lied on the battlefield for days, waiting for someone to come get them, because you had nothing like combat medics at this time, who would gather the wounded from the field. They were brought to a field hospital, where most likely they would be knocked out with chloroform and then have a limb amputated by a surgeon who had almost nothing but a saw. But both died as a result of their injuries. Their bodies were laid to rest in a shallow burial pit, and this pit was intermixed with amputated limbs from other soldiers wounded in the battle. Most likely, the medics and surgeons may have been operating when the battle was still going on and simply didn't have time to confer any more rights on them. Then these soldiers were lost to history. But in 2014, the National Park Service first encountered the remains during a utility project. They were able to identify the remains as Union soldiers and work with the Army to give these soldiers an honorable final resting place. Beneath the surface, they found two nearly complete human skeletons and several artifacts, including buttons from a Union sack jacket, a 577 Enfield bullet, three pieces of a 31 caliber lead buckshot, and an assemblage of 11 arms and legs. The discovery was something rare, a battlefield surgeon's burial pit. This was the first time such a burial pit had ever been excavated and studied at a Civil War battlefield. On this episode, I'm talking with Brandon Byes, who's the superintendent of Manassas National Battlefield Park. He's going to talk about what this discovery tells us about Civil War combat medicine and the new light this sheds on the horrific nature of warfare in the 19th century and how people manage to do their best in horrific situations. Hope you enjoy this discussion with Brandon Byes. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Sure, happy to be here.
Well, I'm very interested to discuss this discovery having to do with the Second Battle of Manassas. But before we get into that, I'm curious about your profession that led you to work on this discovery. You're an archaeologist and you're working with a Civil War discovery. And I don't, and lots of people don't think of archaeology when they think of the Civil War. They imagine ancient Greek civilization or Hittites or something that's thousands of years old. So first, can you tell me about your work as an archaeologist of the Civil War and what that typically entails?
Sure. So I currently am serving as the superintendent of Manassas National Battlefield Park, but indeed my background, my start in the National Park Service is as a historical archaeologist. And in that case, particularly here in the United States, historical archaeology is a little different than, say, prehistoric archaeology, in that it's looking at really the last, 300-400 years of American history. And like you said, a lot of people are surprised to hear that we spend a considerable amount of time, particularly in the United States, looking at the archaeology of warfare, of the American Civil War, and frankly, of much more recent things than that. You might be surprised to hear that there's very active archaeology that goes on, even looking at World War II sites from just 70 years ago. And so it doesn't have to be 2,000-3,000 years ago for us to be interested in the subject. Certainly here in the United States, people are very interested in their history, and using archaeology is one of those tools that we can use. It's really critical, particularly in a military context, say on a Civil War battlefield, we can learn a lot from archaeology that you might not expect. For example, a lot of people might assume that we know everything there is to know about where troops were deployed or where units were stationed, where artillery was stationed, just because there was so much written during the American Civil War. That's not entirely the case, and it's also not always accurate. And so we can use archaeology at battlefields to really tell us precise information about where troops were located, where they fell back to, where supply depots were, all kinds of information like that. But we can also use archaeology to tell us an awful lot about just the common soldier by looking not just at the battlefields, but at the locations where they were encamped, both temporary encampments or long-term encampments, where they were living, what kind of food they were eating, what their conditions were like. All of those things provide us evidence that isn't necessarily always in the written record. And so that's why archaeology of these sites is so important.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because we could assume that, oh, we know where the troops went because Robert E. Lee gave an order for this cavalry unit to do a flanking maneuver. But maybe you would discover that, well, he gave the order, but it wasn't actually carried out, or they failed, or something like that. Do you find discoveries of that nature?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we can look at the historical record, and we look at the historical record all the time. But we have certainly found instances where, well, you know, the historic record says that the left flank, for example, of the Union charge at the deep cut at Second Manassas extended to this certain location. But then we go out and we do archaeology, and we find evidence, for example, of artillery fire that was aimed at troops at a different location. For example, we can tell by the type of artillery being used against troops what the approximate range might have been that the artillerists were shooting at. Some folks have heard of a type of artillery used during the Civil War called canister. Canister essentially turns a cannon into a giant shotgun. Canister is really only effective at a range of 300 yards or so. You wouldn't use it at ranges much beyond that. We have found evidence of canister being used at locations where we thought the nearest troops were 600 yards away. But the fact that we found it where we did means that the troops actually got significantly closer than the historic record actually indicated.
Well, I want to dive into this discovery and all of its implications, but for listeners who don't know that much about the Civil War beyond it was a battle over slavery, states' rights, all that, could you just give a brief overview of what's happening at the Battle of Second Manassas? Why was it fought, and what's happening with this battle?
Sure. So the Second Battle of Manassas is very significant in that it ultimately became a significant Confederate victory. And at the time it was fought, it was the largest battle fought in the entire Western Hemisphere. Now, that was eclipsed just a few short weeks later with the Battle of Antietam, but it was a huge battle. It ultimately resulted in about 3,000, a little over 3,000 killed, and well over 20,000 total casualties. To set the stage, both armies at this time were actually located in the week preceding the battle, much closer to the area around Fredericksburg, Virginia, and it was a little bit of a stalemate. There was a larger Union army facing the Confederate army under the general command, of course, of Robert E. Lee. And Lee and his corps commanders, Longstreet and Jackson, devised a plan to they intended to split their armies and to fool the Union army into thinking that the Confederates were still there. But in the middle of the night, Jackson and his corps basically left, went a completely opposite direction from what anybody ever expected, and a matter of a day and a half later showed up after a phenomenal march of almost 50 miles or so at Manassas Junction, which was basically in the rear of the Union Army. And this was the major supply depot for the Union Army in this part of Virginia. You could think of Manassas Junction almost like the modern, like the Civil War version of a Costco for an army. There was everything you could get in bulk quantities at this, everything from just huge amounts of rations, uniforms, equipment, liquor, horses. I mean, you name it, it was all there. It was really what, if this depot fell, it would significantly decrease the ability for the Union Army to continue their attack. And of course, the the thinking at the time was that the Union was continuing to press on the Confederate capital of Richmond. And so this was an attempt to get them away from Richmond, get in their rear, and try to destroy this depot. It was very successful. Jackson's Corps gets to Manassas Junction without the Union really having a real clue that anything was going on. And then all of a sudden, the Union's getting reports of this action. And so they start moving, and they have no idea where Stonewall Jackson is. At the same time, Longstreet, he starts to send his troops on the exact same march, just a few days behind. And so now at this point, the Union really has no idea where the Confederates are. Meanwhile, the Union sets up a position in the vicinity of Manassas, just north of Manassas Junction on the battlefield that they had fought at just 13 months earlier at the First Battle of Manassas. The advantage is that Confederates like Stonewall Jackson, they have an understanding of what the terrain features are like because they were just there 13 months ago. And so Stonewall Jackson sets up his corps in a defensive line and a location called the Unfinished Railroad. The Unfinished Railroad essentially acted as a giant trench. It was a giant earthwork. It's exactly what it sounds like. It was an unfinished railroad bed. Sometimes it was a cut, sometimes it was a fill, but it was miles long, and it made for a ready-made entrenched position. And he set his troops there and waited for the Union to try to come and find him. And that's essentially what happened and what led to the beginning of the battle.
Wow, that was quite an overview. Although you are superintendent of the park, so I guess it stands to reason you would know it pretty well. So that makes sense.
Yeah, pretty well. But my knowledge pales in comparison to what some of our interpreters know who give these interpretive programs on a daily basis at the park. And I would certainly encourage any of your visitors or your listeners who are curious about the history to come to the park and get even a much, much more detailed background than that.
Well, okay, so you work at the park, and there's this recent discovery of remains of Civil War soldiers. Could you describe how this discovery was found, and what was it?
Sure. So the discovery was first made actually in about October of 2014 was when the initial traces were discovered. The park was in the process of putting in a utility line, and we had done archaeology in advance, and we always do that to make sure that we're not going to disturb any unknown archaeological resources. And the area had been cleared from an archaeological perspective. But of course, that's always just using the best methods we have available. Short of doing all the digging in advance, there's no way to really know. So the utility line excavation went through, and the park staff were using a backhoe, and we had an archaeologist there monitoring just to be certain, and we do this in many cases, just to be certain that nothing is disturbed or to stop work if it is. And that archaeologist noticed that small bits of bone were coming out with the scoops of dirt in the backfill. Those bone fragments were collected, and they were taken back to a National Park Service lab where they were cleaned and analyzed. And the initial indications in the lab were that they were actually human bone. However, we were not completely certain about this, so we conferred with our partners at the Smithsonian Institution, at the National Museum of Natural History. We worked with that laboratory. We've got 3 decades of experience and relationship working with them, and so they are our go-to partners when it comes to trying to potentially identify human bone that is found in national park settings in this part of the country. And so we took those samples to the Smithsonian, and they verified that not only were these human bones, but that one of them had cut marks on it, and that was very significant because that revealed that these were likely the result of an amputation. And so the Park Service then decided to go out about a year later to conduct a focused archaeological investigation to try to find exactly what this archaeological feature was and determine the size of it, the significance, because we wanted to make sure that there wasn't any future activities that could disturb it. And so that project went forward. After several days of looking for it, we did find what turned out to be the surgeon's pit. What was unexpected was, number one, how incredibly shallow it was, and also the fact that there were not only amputated remains, but the remains of at least 2 nearly complete sets of remains of two Union soldiers that were in this surgeon's pit. That was unprecedented. Nothing like that has ever been found before, and I'm not aware even of any historical records from the Civil War talking about the commingling of complete sets of remains with amputated limbs all in one burial pit. So this was very, very significant. Based on the recommendations of our partners at the Smithsonian, who actually did come out to assist with this excavation once we had made the discovery, they recommended that the remains be removed from the ground because at this point they had been exposed, they would degrade at a faster rate, and they were so incredibly shallow, we had some real concerns about any future disturbance. And so at this point, the remains that were exposed to the archaeology were removed and then cleaned and taken back to the lab for any potential work for identification or further research.
Just to give some context of this discovery, could you describe just a little bit about what a Civil War combat medic would be doing and how would he treat patients and what sort of injuries would a typical Civil War soldier suffer that would inform the kind of treatment that he would receive by a doctor?
Sure. So, you know, you use the phrase kind of combat medic, and I want to point out that that's a fairly recent or more modern term. During the Civil War, there were very few who were trained in, you know, what we would call basic first aid today or medical treatment. Typically, if a soldier was wounded in combat, if they themselves could still move, or if not, then maybe their colleagues would try to move them as quickly as possible to basically a field hospital or just a gathering site for the wounded. They would most likely not receive any first aid at the location where they were injured. Not much would be performed, sometimes even for days. Unfortunately, you know, if someone was shot, they themselves might try to stop the bleeding, but short of that, there was not a whole lot that was done at the moment that they were injured. And I'll talk for a moment about the types of injuries. The injuries that were represented in this archaeological discovery, in this case, they were all bullet wounds. And in many of the cases, particularly with amputations, these were bullets that obviously had struck bone. And in all of the cases of amputations, they had passed through the body, causing just horrific traumatic injuries to the limbs. The bullets that were being used during the American Civil War came in two basic sizes. First of all, these were lead bullets. They were very heavy, and they would have generally been about 58 caliber, so that's a little bit more than a half an inch in diameter, and that would have been a rifled bullet that would have been spinning. It would have been very, very accurate. And then there was another type of round that was called a buck and ball round, and that consisted of one 65 caliber, so 0.65 inches, round ball, as well as three 31 caliber buckshot that would be all packed together and all fired at once out of a smoothbore musket. Not very accurate at long range, but very deadly at a closer range. And we found evidence of both types of munitions being used against soldiers in this burial pit. Something like a small buckshot, it very well may break a bone, but it in itself may not cause death. But it would still injure the soldier to the point that they were incapacitated. But those larger 65 caliber musket balls could do just horrific damage to the human bones. So these soldiers that suffered these injuries, they would have been shot. They may have dragged themselves to an aid station. They may have had comrades carry them in a blanket, or they may have laid out on the battlefield for days until somebody could recover them and take them to basically what would have been an aid station, where they essentially would have been triaged. A battlefield surgeon, and that's really who's doing this work. There were a handful of trained surgeons. There were not a lot of other people that were trained in medicine. So unless you came across one of these surgeons or they came to you, that you were not going to get any professional medical treatment. And so when these surgeons came to you and you were there at the aid station, they would do a quick assessment. and they would try to assess, is this something that we can, is there something we can do now to save this person? Is this person, can it wait? Or is there nothing that we can do to save this individual? And in this surgeon's pit, we found evidence of both of those. We found the amputated limbs of 11 soldiers who the surgeon decided that by amputating that limb, they could try to save their life. But the two complete sets of remains, those soldiers, we refer to them as Burial 1 and Burial 2, they had received wounds. They had made it to the field hospital. They did not die in the field. They made it to this location where most likely a surgeon looked at them and determined, because of where they were shot, that there was nothing that they could do in this field hospital setting to try to save them. And so they were essentially set aside while the surgeons worked and other soldiers whose lives could be saved.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then, Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now, Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And if I understand correctly, at this time period, amputation was very frequently done because this is before bacteriology. This is before antibiotics. There's a fear of a limb turning gangrene, which it often would. There's not exit wounds. The bullets would go into the body, shatter bones. So they did lots of amputations. Is that almost the default response, or how else would they try to treat patients?
Yeah, so certainly I would say yes, an amputation is the default response for an injury to one of the extremities. I mean, obviously, if someone is shot through their body, through their torso, their head, their neck, there was not a lot that could be done. It's amazing how long soldiers lingered with wounds like that. There are accounts of soldiers being shot through and through the bowels or the intestines or the stomach, and actually surviving for a remarkable period of time, up well over a month sometimes, before they ultimately would succumb to their injuries because of just lacking the modern surgical techniques that we have, where today doctors could, you know, operate on someone and cut someone open and repair blood vessels and all that. That just couldn't be done during the Civil War. So if you were shot through the torso during the Civil War in a field hospital, short of stopping the bleeding, there was really not much that could be done. If you were shot through a limb, then yes, the default response was usually, let me clarify, if you were shot through a limb and there was bone damage, the default response reaction by a surgeon would typically be to amputate the limb. And the amputation would be performed as close to the wound as they could, but they had to amputate at a location that that had not been affected. Because if they cut in a location where there was still bone that was shattered, this would cause all kinds of problems, resulting in infection, bits of bone that would, you know, it would ooze out of the wound over time, just horrible things like that. And so, you know, because again, these are not neat little holes through a piece of bone. This is a bullet hitting a long bone and shattering the bone into 15 or 20 pieces with no solid bone to be found within, in some cases, 3-4 inches in either direction. These were horrible wounds. And so there was not a lot that could be done at that time other than to amputate. And the lower the amputation, I should say, the further away from the torso that amputation could be done, the higher likelihood of survival. But there were absolutely times where even that amputation was infected. And if that happened, if they got gangrene, then you might see an additional amputation performed closer to the body to remove, you know, that infected portion. But once you got to, frankly, within a few inches of the, you know, the shoulder joints, the hip bones, there was really nothing that could be done. And we found that in the example of the soldier referred to as Burial One. He was wounded through the buttocks with a Confederate Enfield bullet that entered the top of his femur, just about 3 inches or so from the head of the femur. It then exploded his femur just below that, and there was nothing that the surgeon could do. The only way to save somebody like that is to do what's called a disarticulation amputation, where the entire femur is taken out of the socket, out of the pelvis, and that just could not be done in the setting like a field hospital.
That's a major operation, and when I read accounts of the wounded in Civil War, it sends chills down my spine in a way that few other wars do, since weapons are deadlier than previous wars when you have rifle bullets, but medicine hasn't really caught up from earlier conflicts. And how precise could these medics be? They have saws, but when we hear that, we just imagine somebody going at it as if they were going at it a log and just as imprecise. But my intuition tells me that's inaccurate. What does your research and your findings on this site say?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that is one of those those misperceptions that we really could disprove by looking at the skill. We could tell the skill level of the surgeons by looking at these wounds. And I want to be very clear, a tremendous amount of this research and these conclusions have been reached by our colleagues at the Smithsonian, at their physical anthropology laboratory. But they have looked at these cut marks, for example, and they've been able to tell that these are very highly trained surgeons that were making very purposeful operations, very purposeful amputations. You do not see what you might call a false start. So where the saw, you know, they start to cut, but then, you know, it something moves and they have to start cutting again. There's nothing like that. The cuts are very straight. They are very precise and they're very regular. And there's very little breakage of the end of the bones. All these kinds of research. And the Smithsonian has done spectacular work where they've been doing work with very high-powered microscopes where you can count and see. And this is fascinating, but it's also just horrifying to think of this amputation as it takes place. You can count the number of saw kind of strokes back and forth that it took to amputate these legs. So just very precise research that we can do. And that tells us that the surgeon or surgeons who were performing this work were highly trained. They knew what they were doing. And they were absolutely doing the best they could to try to save these soldiers' lives.
I'm guessing that soldiers, would they have chloroform? Is that what they would use if that were even available?
So yes, that's what typically would have been used. There were some other drugs that could be used as well, but that was most common. And I do, you know, there's another kind of misperception out there that amputate, you know, the phrase bite the bullet, and that a soldier would bite down on a bullet and they'd be conscious while this operation was being performed. You know, that probably did happen a little bit, but by and large, these surgeons it would be unlikely, unless they absolutely had to, it'd be unlikely that they would perform an amputation without something that would knock out the soldier. So the soldier almost certainly would have been unconscious during the operation.
In terms of the specific remains that you found at the site, what did those remains tell you? You mentioned that we can see how skilled the surgeons were. Did they give you any other information?
Well, certainly they tell us, first of all, about the soldiers and a little bit about who they were. Now, we have yet to make any positive identifications of either the two complete sets or the amputated limbs. But by looking at these remains, we can start to learn about the soldiers. And even if we never learn what their name was, we can learn more about them. We have an idea of their approximate ages, of their stature, of how, you know, how tall they were. We have an idea from the isotope analysis that was performed where they were born, what part of the country they were from. And so we can start to piece this together to the point that we can start to think, well, maybe these soldiers are from this unit or from that unit. So we can learn about the history of the battle, but we can learn about them as human beings. And it allows us to really personalize the story, because instead of just being the remains, unnamed remains, bones of a soldier, we can start to learn a little bit more about that person. And so that's one area that we can learn. We can learn about the individuals that were there. Again, we already touched upon this. We can learn a little bit about the surgical techniques, about the decisions that were made, the very difficult decisions that were made, particularly in the cases of the two complete sets, the very clear decision that was made not to attempt to save that soldier's life. And we can also learn, we start to look at, in this particular case, we start to ask some questions about who was doing the work. Were there specialists in certain types of surgery? Because it's interesting that these soldiers, almost all of what is represented here are for the amputations, are leg bones. So there's one arm, but everything else are legs.
Really?
And so was this a surgeon? Yeah, in this particular case, what's been recovered, of the 11 amputated limbs, 10 of them are legs. And so was this a surgeon who was basically a specialist on legs and amputating legs? And so was there a very intentional organization that was done, even in these chaotic days following the battle, where these amputations may have been getting performed, even in that setting with such limited resources, was it, hey, if you have a severe leg wound, take this soldier to such and such field hospital, and that surgeon is who will deal with them? So it starts raising those kinds of questions that we've never even really known to ask before. And the other thing is, it has shown us, just from the types of wounds they have, that these are soldiers that were in likely in some sort of an offensive position. These are not soldiers that were hiding down below, a stone wall or a fence or in a trench or something like that, because many of the wounds are in the legs or, again, sometimes the arms. But these are not, if you would see many more wounds to, say, the upper body, to the head, if these were soldiers that were largely protected. But the fact that we have so many leg wounds means that these soldiers were most likely moving one direction or the other when they were shot. And that's significant.
Well, I'd love it if you could walk through this process of how the forensic work is done, that you can tell, like you said, by isotopes, that somebody is from one location or another location. I'm always astounded how archaeologists can basically take something as small as teeth remains and then piece together the environmental history of Sumeria, something like that. But so, for example, you mentioned the isotope analysis tells us where they're from. How did they figure that out? And how did you figure out these other factors that let you know the characteristics of these soldiers?
Sure. So a lot of this, to be fair, is the work that's being done at our partners at the Smithsonian Institution. They're really the experts here. I can tell you my understanding of how they go about this, but a lot of this forensics work is being done by our partners at the Smithsonian. But essentially, for an isotope analysis, you take a very, very, very small sample of the bone, and they're able to perform basically some sort of a chemical analysis on it, where they can compare it to existing maps of isotopes that are found in the drinking water across the world. And so the isotopes, they get their traces from the drinking water that you drank as you were growing up. And so we know from these maps that, again, the majority of these troops, that they are representative of isotopes that would have been in the drinking water in New York and the New England region. So even that is just, it's just kind of mind-boggling. That's just to think, from a little tiny piece of bone, we can find out as a kid where that individual was drinking their water. And so then some of the other ways that we can tell more about them, just from taking the measurements, usually of the long bones, if you have a complete long bone, like a leg or an arm, you can make a fairly accurate estimate as to the stature, the height of that individual, usually to within an inch. Certainly for the two complete skeletal remains that we recovered, we feel very confident about the heights of those individuals. We can also look at things like to determine their age. We can look if you have the cranium. You can look at what's called the sutures. The sutures are basically where you're headed. Your skull is not one solid piece of bone. It's actually a number of bones that have all grown together. And you can look at how tight those sutures are and make an estimate on the age. You can look at teeth. Teeth are a major indicator in the amount of tooth wear that is done, and you can tell how much but the age is. You can also tell a little bit about their diet as well, and that might lead to clues to where they are. And you can look for signs of things in the bones, in the backbones, in the long bones, for signs of arthritis. All of those combined can help experts, in forensics anthropology make pretty accurate guesses as to the age. So in many of the cases, they're able to narrow down an age range to within about 4 years.
Well, for you as a Civil War expert, when these two remains, complete remains, were discovered, I can guess that your mind was probably racing of, okay, we have this fact and this fact and this fact. They were probably this type of soldier in this regiment from this area, or trying to triangulate this information to lock down who they were. So can you tell me, if you had to guess, and I'm not going to hold you to this, I promise, but if you had to guess who these two soldiers were, where were they from, what sort of soldier were they, what unit were they in, what would you guess, and could you sort of show your math on how you would arrive at that conclusion?
Sure. So again, making you hold me to the promise that what I'm about to go through would be a likely scenario of these soldiers, perhaps one of the more likely scenarios, but short of ultimately making an identification, it's hard to ever know for certain. But that
right.
being said, based off of everything that we know about the location in the battlefield where they were found, of the isotope analysis and the part of country they were from, of the types of wounds that they were suffering, we think that it's most likely that these were soldiers that were engaged in a Union attack of a corps of troops under the general named Fitzjohn Porter. His corps of almost 10,000 or so Union soldiers made an attack on a location called the Deep Cut. The Deep Cut was a spot along this unfinished railroad that I mentioned. And this was basically a open ground assault where, depending where they were in the lines, they had to cross anywhere from 300 to 600 yards of open terrain, and they were under fire that entire time. This was described by some, and in fact, actually described by some Confederates who were on the receiving end and who witnessed this charge. Those same Confederates were later participants in Pickett's charge, which is, of course, is perhaps better known at Gettysburg just a year later. And they said themselves, having gone through Pickett's charge, that what these Union soldiers had to go through in their attack was greater and worse than what they themselves had to go through in Pickett's charge. So that gives you a sense of just how horrific and deadly this charge was. There were whole regiments, take for example, the 17th New York Infantry. And I mention that regiment specifically because that's one of these regiments where we potentially some of these soldiers could have come from. The 17th New York went into this charge with something around 235, 250 soldiers. And by the end of the charge, they could only account for about 50 or 60 soldiers. So this was particularly deadly for that unit. Now, over time, some more of them made it back to the regiment, but they suffered just horrific casualties. And so, in this potential scenario, I think you could be looking at soldiers potentially from New York, from a New York regiment. I think there's a very good bet that some of these soldiers are from New York, and that they were engaged in this charge. And again, that fits with the types of wounds that we're seeing. I'll give you one very specific example. In the case of Burial One, the soldier who was shot with a Confederate Enfield bullet through his buttocks. He was shot through the buttocks. He was not facing the direction that he was shot. In fact, the experts in the Smithsonian have been able to tell that at the moment he was shot, he was bearing weight on the leg that was shot because of the way the basically the way, the manner in which the bone exploded, it just popped in a certain direction that showed that he was running or swiftly walking. Basically, the entirety of his weight was on that right leg. And again, he was shot in the rear. So based on the accounts we have of this particular charge, we know that the Confederates did not let up, and they were shooting the Union, not only as they were attacking, but as they were retreating. So It is highly plausible that this is a Union soldier who was shot during the retreat from the Deep Cut.
Wow. And for people who don't know much about the Civil War, what you described is an example of how grisly it was, where you have tactics that were developed over half a century ago using these charges, which might work well when you have an enemy with smoothbore muskets that are only accurate to maybe 50 yards, but they're using these tactics in eras when you have rifles that could be accurate up to 200, 300 yards even. So that just adds a human element to how grisly this battle was.
Just a quick add to jump in there, the technology that was used in the Revolutionary War, War of 1812, and the beginning of the Civil War, what these tactics were based off of was this smoothbore, buck-and-ball kind of technology. And generally speaking, those muskets were accepted to be accurate to a range of about 65 yards or so. The Enfield rifled musket, the type of gun that would have fired the fatal round for this Burial One, the one soldier we referenced, that musket, now I'm not going to say that you could definitely hit a man at this distance, but that rifled musket, the sights on that went up to 1,100 yards.
Wow. So for them charging for 600 yards, you'd be sitting ducks for...
You could be under rifle fire from the moment you advanced. They advanced out of the cover of some woods. From the moment they stepped out of those woods, they would have been within range of rifle fire.
Yeah, and how long would it take? That would be a few minutes, I imagine, of having to charge.
It's more than a few minutes if you're being shot out by artillery and infantry and having to charge uphill in the heat of August. Although it was a relatively quick attack, this was more than 1 or 2 minutes. And some of these regiments that actually did make it up to the edge of the unfinished railroad. In fact, there's one very, this is a small moment in the fight, but it's important to just show just how close the combat could be, that despite being under fire for 500-600 yards, some of these New York regiments made it up right up to the edge of the unfinished railroad, and the Confederate defenders ran out of ammunition.
Wow.
And so they actually had to pick up rocks from this railroad bed, and it's known as the Rock Fight, and they began hurling rocks back at the Union defenders who were just, 10, 15 yards away. And some of these Union soldiers were so surprised, even though they had ammunition, they started picking up the rocks and throwing them back. Now, this didn't last very long, but it just goes to just show just kind of the insanity of what combat could be like during the Civil War.
Wow. Yeah. That makes you wonder, not be surprised that so many died, but of this regiment of, I think you said there were about 250 soldiers from New York, 50 survived even, I mean, with conditions like that.
Yeah, this was, I mean, there were, you look at, one telling way to look at this are the flags. There's so many examples, both Union and Confederate, of surviving flags in the American Civil War. And in the case, for example, of the 17th New York, they went through a number of color bearers, the soldier holding the flag. Numerous ones of those were cut down and killed. We actually have the original flag of the 17th New York in our museum collection. In fact, we recently had it restored, and there are numerous locations in the flag where there are patches that had to be applied because of the bullets passing through the flag.
You described the soldier interred at Burial One. The soldier at Burial Two, were you able to arrive at any sort of conclusions about how he died?
Yeah, so we can, perhaps not as strong from a physical anthropology forensic evidence as Burial One, but one very interesting thing to note with Burial Two, he was struck with either one complete or potentially multiple buck and ball rounds. I referred to those a few moments ago. He was shot through the right shoulder with one of those 65 caliber round balls, which passed through his shoulder. He was also struck by three buckshot, one also in the same shoulder, which remained behind, which we did recover, one in one of his calves or shins, and one in the groin. And all three of those buckshot were still in the grave with him. If all of those, the three buckshot and the one round ball, came from one blast, from one round, then that most likely means that this soldier was shot from a range of, you know, certainly less than 100 yards and potentially as close as 50 yards away. So that tells us that this soldier was very close to the man who shot him.
And he probably was there on the battlefield until someone was able to take him to the infirmary tent.
Yeah, in this case, it's hard to imagine that a soldier with that many wounds would have been able to make it there. Certainly burial one, they would have had to have been carried to a field hospital. But it's even the soldier with burial two with a leg wound, a wound in the groin, and his shoulder was completely shattered. In fact, we were able to surmise from the archaeological evidence, from the placement of the buttons of his uniform jacket, the way they laid in the soil 150 plus years later, that his jacket had been partially removed and kind of cradled around his right shoulder, the shoulder that was so severely damaged, in a way to kind of immobilize the shoulder and to try to keep it from moving. And we could tell just from the pattern and the direction the buttons were facing in the ground that his jacket had never been removed, but had been used to try to bind up that wound to keep it stable.
Oh, okay. When you were describing the burial, I just imagined a skeleton, but it sounds like the parts of the uniform were still intact. What were you able to infer from the burial? Was he in a certain sort of pose, or what was that like?
So both soldiers were aligned next to each other, with, you know, their heads pointing in the same direction and whatnot. But they were essentially laid in, they may have been laid in or on a blanket. We did see some staining in the soil from what could have been the remnants of a blanket that perhaps they were laid on or wrapped in. But you know, this was not, what one might term kind of a proper Christian burial. These were, again, I want to, you know, remind you and your listeners that there were amputated limbs that were mixed in. We know from the layering that when this pit was first dug, most likely some limbs went in first, and then one of the soldiers, and then some more limbs, and then another soldier. And so this was not necessarily a soldier with, you know, their arms crossed across their chest or something like that. They were placed in a manner that tells us this was either a very quick burial or was done in very, very, very far from ideal situations by people who were just trying to get the remains in the ground and out of the way as quickly as possible.
Right. It's easy to be glib about these doctors and think, oh, they're barbaric. They have no, you know, love of humanity. If I were a Southerner who had some beef with the North still, I could say, oh, look at those Yankees. They just don't care about human life. But what were other things do you think this inferred from the condition in which he was interred? You mentioned that they had limited resources. They, I would imagine they'd probably dealt with thousands of cases and weren't really in a situation where they could do any sort of proper burial. But the situation and the conditions in which they were buried, what other theories did you come up with?
Yeah, so, I mean, certainly we, again, to reemphasize, we know that this was done in a rather quick manner, probably. What we still don't know for certain is whether or not this was a burial that was done as the battle was raging on, and so thus there was an urgency, or was it, and some of the evidence is starting to point towards this latter theory, was it, were these soldiers who were operated on in the days that followed the battle? We know that that there were surgeons treating the wounded on the battlefield for over a week after the battle took place there. So if you can imagine soldiers who were lying virtually unattended for a week. It was just a horrible situation. At first, there was a terrible, terrible rainstorm on September 1st, just a couple of days after the battle, and then just horrible heat in the upper 80s and the 90s. And so we know the conditions were terrible. We also know that there were just a handful of Union soldiers that were detailed on a burial duty. Keep in mind that when this battle was fought, it was a huge Confederate victory. The Confederates buried many of their dead, but many of the Union dead were left out. And so these burials were not taking place until, in some cases, a week, maybe even a week and a half, 2 weeks after the soldiers were killed. So without getting too gruesome, you can imagine you can't really imagine what the conditions would have been like for those soldiers who were doing the burials, for the stench, the decomposition. They most likely were simply trying to get soldiers in the ground and put dirt over the decomposing bodies just as quickly as they could.
I understand that these two soldiers were given a proper burial in Arlington National Cemetery recently. And could you tell me about how that decision was arrived at, and when they were being interred, what was sort of the symbolic importance of them being interred at a cemetery with full honors instead of the situation they were previously left at?
So I just want to clarify, they have not yet been interred at
Arlington. Oh, okay. Okay.
We have transferred the remains to the United States Army. That took place on June 19th for burial, likely later this summer at Arlington. So that just to be clear, that has not yet taken place. The discussions about what should we do with these complete sets of remains, you know, we had some good conversations about this. Some Civil War battlefields have cemeteries on them. In fact, a number of them do for Union soldiers, Gettysburg, Antietam, Fredericksburg, and Spotsylvania. They have cemeteries for Union soldiers. Manassas does not. We do have a Confederate cemetery where there are approximately 400 Confederate soldiers buried at Manassas, but not Union soldiers. However, there is a very significant precedent and example that led us to thinking that the appropriate final resting place was Arlington. And that is at the conclusion of the American Civil War, at battlefields across America, there was an attempt made to recover as many of these soldier remains as could be done. And so in 1865 and 1866, burial parties went throughout the battlefields of Manassas and the surrounding countryside, and they recovered the remains of 2,111 Union soldiers from the Manassas battlefield and some of the immediate surrounding areas. And they were all interred in what is referred to as the Tomb of the Civil War Unknowns at what was then basically the brand new Arlington National Cemetery. This burial was done, I believe, in 1866. And you to this day can go to Arlington and visit the Tomb of the Civil War Unknowns and see the inscription about the soldiers from Manassas. And these are, again, Union soldiers in basically a large crypt-like underground mass burial. And so because there was that precedent for soldiers from Manassas going to Arlington, we felt that was really that was really appropriate in this case.
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. I mean, you discussed how this sheds light on the past, the significance it has today in the present. To wrap things up, what significance do you think it had? It gave you new information about the past, about how combat medics, or I guess that's an anachronism, combat medics, how surgeons dealt with the sick in overwhelming conditions, and then also giving proper respect to those who perished over 150 years ago. But yeah, to wrap things up, what do you think is the most significant aspect about this discovery?
Well, it's an unprecedented find to find this combination of amputated limbs and complete soldiers, and just the amputated limbs themselves. There has never been a set of amputated limbs in what you would call a surgeon's pit or a limbs pit ever discovered and archaeologically excavated at a Civil War battlefield ever. So this is the first this has ever happened. This is the first time we've ever had a chance to look at this and look at the techniques that were used on an actual battlefield. So that in itself is incredibly significant. But I really want to, you know, it's really easiest for us to have, you know, this, you know, at times rather casual conversation about the scientific side, about the research. The reason we do this science, the reason we do this research is to be able to share these stories, is to be able to share with our visitors the significance of the Civil War, the horrificness of what it was like to fought to fight, to be a surgeon, to be wounded, to go through all of this. And the Civil War was an ugly, gruesome business. And being able to see up close the wounds that were suffered by the soldiers and the decisions that were made by the surgeons, and to be able to start to say that this was probably a soldier from New York. He was probably between 30 and 34 years old. He was about 5'5", 5'6". You know, he may have had a wife and children. You know, it starts to personalize this, the human toll of the war. So instead of just looking at statistics that say that at the first and second battles of Manassas, there were 4,000 men who were killed, and tens of thousands who were wounded. It personalizes it by actually seeing the wounds and learning about the people who suffered those wounds. They're no longer anonymous. Even though we may not know their names, they are not forgotten, and we are learning about them, and we are teaching others about them and the significance of what they did and of the American Civil War. And to me, that's really the critical, most important of all this, is it allows us to take science and research and put a personal story behind what happened during the American Civil War and combat faced by Civil War soldiers.
Brandon, thank you for sharing all of this with us. You are a superintendent at Manassas National Battlefield Park. If people want to learn more about that online, where is the best place to go to?
Absolutely. So our website is a great place to start your visit, and that is at www.nps.gov/MANA, M-A-N-A. And we even have a specific part of the site dedicated to this discovery where people can go watch a brief video, see some photographs, and read a lot more about this unprecedented discovery.
I'll be sure to link that into the show notes, so if people want to check that out, they can do so there. Brandon, thank you for joining us.
Super. Great. More than happy to. Enjoyed the discussion.
All right. Well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you want to support the show and help me keep producing this content, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to do that, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com, and there you'll find instructions. Two, join our Facebook group, which you can find if you just search for History Unplugged. And please like and share posts that I put up about new episodes. Three, submit a question to me so that I can answer it on air. You can email me at info@historyonthenet.com or leave a voicemail. And again, go to historyunplugpodcast.com and you'll find instructions. Lastly, and I think this one is the best, is to join the History Unplugged membership program. You can find out how by going to patreon.com/unplugged. If you sign up, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with complete access to the History Unplugged archives. Right now, there are only the most recent 20 episodes on our podcast feed, but you can get all 270 episodes I've ever produced, and they make up hundreds of hours of content, including fan favorite episodes like these. Every president's go-to drink, from Washington's whiskey to Obama's homebrew, Curtis LeMay, World War II's greatest hero or worst war criminal, Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun, and the Barbarian Empires of the Steppe, and finally, an interview with Dan Carlin of Hardcore History on why the German military was better in World War I than World War II. You can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the Eunuch, the Harem Servant Girl, and the Soldier. Plus, History Unplugged's membership program is the only history podcast that's supported by both Barack Obama and Donald Trump, along with Abraham Lincoln and Benjamin Franklin. Finally, I'd like to give a shout-out to one of our wonderful sponsors, and that is Baron Teresa di Ravello e Napoli. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn why. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. Wars made the United States independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Hi, I'm James Early, host of the Key Battles of American History podcast. In each episode, I discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search Key Battles of American History on your favorite podcasting platform.
What do you do when the world around you is falling apart? It's amazing to me how many people are breathing air. They're going about their business and doing the things you're supposed to do. But if you really ask them, they know that on the inside, they are spiritually and emotionally and relationally dead. If we're not careful, all of us can experience that death. When what we need to do, even as the world around us is falling apart, we need to learn how to march when it would be easier to stay where we are and die. Join me each week on the March or Die Show as we discuss that and so much more.